Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We have reached the 20th century in our series about the ideas behind American elections. And today I'm talking to Gary Gerstle about the election of 1912. It was the election that saw the Republicans split. It saw the Democrats recapture the White House after an absence of 20 years, and it changed American politics forever. Gary, in our story, we have reached the election of 1912, and this was another election that was won, as Lincoln's election had been won in 1860, by a candidate. In this case, it was slightly more than 40% of the vote, but it was nowhere near a majority of the popular vote. Woodrow Wilson, the Democratic candidate, won. It's only possible to win a presidential election with around 40% of the vote if the other main party is split. And the Republicans had split in 1912, and they allowed Wilson through the gap. So how did it happen? How was it in 1912 that the Republican Party effectively ended up split between two candidates, one who was the Republican candidate and the other who was a candidate for a third party but had been a Republican president?
Two words, Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt had become president in 1901 when he had been vice president and McKinley had been reelected in 1900 and then was assassinated in September 1901.
And reelected, we should say, having run again against Bryan and defeated him again.
Yes. So Roosevelt ascends to the presidency in 1901 and is elected for the first time in 1904, but experiences it as a reelection because he had served McKinley's entire first term. The tradition was that no one would serve more than full two terms. And so he decides to not run for re-election in 1908, which would have been his prerogative had he chosen to. He also imagined himself putting in place a different kind of Republican Party politics than what McKinley had done. And the term progressive begins to be used at this time. Roosevelt imagines himself as a, on the one hand, reform president and as someone who is elevating the office of the presidency to a position of power and influence that it had not had in for much of the 19th century when Congress, the legislature, was thought to be supreme. He thinks he's leaving his Republican Party movement in the hands of a good man, William Howard Taft. Roosevelt was always a man of many interests, and he goes to Africa to go big game hunting. He rides down the Amazon River. He travels the world. He thinks his life will be about other things. And then he sees Taft's record as president, much more conservative figure, much more cut from a traditional Republican mold, begins to worry that his reform project is being abandoned. And so he begins to think about coming back into politics. And his intention is to run in the Republican Party to win the primaries. But by this time, Taft has taken control of the Republican Party machinery. And if you have a sitting president wanting to be reelected, it is very hard to displace him. And even though Roosevelt does well in the primaries, he cannot displace the Republican Party machine that is engineering Taft's renomination for the presidency. And then because Roosevelt feels the urgency of reform, he founds a new political party called the Progressive Party, which gathers in Chicago in 1912 to nominate him on an independent party ticket. And he does incredibly well for what is another third party movement. It is extraordinarily hard for a third party movement to be successful. So Roosevelt's influence in the 1912 election turns out to be more about influencing politics and policy than getting himself elected again as president of the United States.
He did outpoll Taft So the results were roughly 41% for Wilson, 27.5% for Roosevelt. This is in the popular vote, obviously doesn't translate straightforwardly into the Electoral College, and 23% roughly for Taft. The result was an overwhelming Electoral College victory for Woodrow Wilson, who won 435 electoral votes. There was the Republican candidate Taft, there was the progressive candidate Roosevelt, there was the Democratic candidate Wilson. One of the complications of this era is that Wilson was also a progressive, but a different kind of progressive. And it would be really helpful, not least for me, to try and understand how we map the landscape of progressivism in this period, where we place Roosevelt, where we place Wilson. It turns on a number of things, as I understand it, and one of them is the extent to which they believe that the policies they want to enact need to be enacted by the federal government. How would you characterize the key elements of Roosevelt's progressivism, and then how would we contrast that with Wilson and the democratic, capital D, democratic version?
The phrase that Roosevelt uses to describe his politics is the new nationalism. Phrase he coins when he gives a very important speech in a town in Kansas known as Osawatomie in 1910. And there he lays out a program of powerful central government intervention in the economy to curb the power of elites, to redistribute some of the wealth that American capitalism is reproducing to those in the lower stretches of the social order, and to have the federal government be a regulator of the capitalist system to smooth out the booms and the busts in the electoral cycle, and to bring more equity and justice into the operation of this incredibly powerful but rambunctious system of political economy. He imagines a strong federal government to regulate the economy in a variety of ways. He gains a reputation when he was president as being a trust buster, and a trust buster meant that he was going to break up the trusts. It's a particular term used in America. It's most helpful to understand trusts as corporate power, monopoly power. America at this time had industries that were concentrating the power within those industries in one, two, or three firms, whether it was Rockefeller in petroleum and Andrew Carnegie in steel, three major corporations in the processing and refining of sugar, DuPont in the manufacture and production of chemicals. The power and concentration of corporate America had become extraordinary. And Roosevelt had come to the conclusion that too much power was resting in private hands, and the central government had to intervene in the political economy of America in multiple and powerful ways. He imagines a regulatory regime of oversight. That's the key contribution of his political economy. Wilson, on the surface, adopts a very different approach. If Roosevelt is known for his new nationalism, Wilson is known for his new freedom. And because Wilson comes out of the Democratic Party, which had long been suspicious of central government power, in part because central government power could be used against the slave regimes and then the segregationist regimes that had taken root in the South after the Civil War. His plan is different. He says, I don't want to use government power to regulate corporations. I want to use government power to break up corporations and restore the economy to conditions of genuinely competitive capitalism that had characterized the 19th century. So you break up the big concentrations of wealth and power and you return America to an earlier stage of capitalism. In practice, if you follow this to the logical conclusion, if you're going to break up corporate America, this is actually a more radical plan than what Roosevelt had produced. And so when Wilson comes into power, he does not put this plan into effect. His new freedom becomes almost indistinguishable from Roosevelt's new nationalism. What both imagine is that a strong government is needed to regulate this economy in the public interest. If we throw a third candidate into this, Eugene Victor Debs, socialist, what's his approach to industry? His approach to industry is nationalized corporate property, make it property of the state, and the state will run it in the interests of the people. Nationalization is going to become a very important creed across the 20th century for socialists everywhere. Debs is making this argument in 1912. What's interesting is if we add the percentages that Wilson won, about 42%, Roosevelt 27%, Debs 6% in the election, 75% of the electorate is voting for more government control of private industry. So that this is a different kind of plurality election. This is not really a story of fragmentation. This is a story of three out of every four voters saying that the primary issue confronting America in the early 20th century is a private capitalistic economic system that is out of control. And it's the obligation of a strong central government to find ways to control it in the public interest.
So we have Debs, 6%, which might not sound a lot, but it's a hell of a lot more than in 1896 when it was 0.2% or something. 6% is a significant vote share for a socialist candidate in the United States. Debs, the answer is the government should own the industry. Roosevelt, the answer is the government should regulate the industry. Wilson, the answer is the government should break up the industry. So one of the questions then is then how? What are the instruments of government? Which bit of the government should do this? Are we talking about executive power? Are we talking about legislative power? Where does the Supreme Court come into this? Because a lot of these cases, contentious cases, including cases involving labor and organizing, but also the regulation of business in America, would reach the Supreme Court at various points. And the Supreme Court, from the progressive perspective, was not helping.
The Supreme Court was not helping. This is imagined first and foremost as a legislative program that's going to be passed by Congress, and Congress passes major reforms during the progressive era to strengthen the central government and put it in a position to regulate aspects of private industry. This is a very important element.
So in a way, the legislature has to empower the executive.
That is what is happening. The legislature is empowering the executive. The federal government begins to grow. It was very small in size at this time. And during peacetime, it begins to have new agencies that are going to be responsible for directing private economic affairs. Wilson also establishes the Federal Reserve, which is a public-private system of regulating financial markets and using monetary and fiscal policies to smooth out the booms and busts in the business cycle. So a public-private arrangement for managing finance, addressing the issues that had surfaced around gold and silver in the 19th century. Ultimately, they were not about gold and silver. Ultimately, they were about having a financial system that could handle the challenges of an advanced industrial economy. So legislation had to be passed. The presidency was at the same time empowered by this legislation. But at every step, they ran into challenges from the court system in America. And the key question, which surfaced again and again and again in the Supreme Court, was, does the central government have the power to manage the economy in the way in which progressives wanted them to manage? The Constitution was interpreted as giving certain powers to the central government and certain powers to state governments. And the courts from the 19th century forward developed the doctrine that whatever powers the federal government had to be specifically enumerated in the Constitution. And if a power was not enumerated, the federal government did not have it. It resided with the states. The Constitution gave the federal government the power to declare war. That was unambiguous. The Constitution gave the federal government the power to regulate interstate commerce, to run a post office. These were unambiguous declarations of power residing in the federal government. The Constitution says nothing directly about the ability of the federal government to regulate manufacturing. One of the questions arises late 19th and early 20th century is, can the federal government possess this power? 75% of the American people wanted the government to regulate industry and the public interest. It's not clear that the Constitution gives the government that power. what legislators begin to do is to stretch the meaning of the Commerce Clause. They argue that commerce implies manufacturing. If goods are being traded across interstate lines, goods are traveling between Ohio and Indiana, out to California, south and north. This implies a power to regulate manufacturing. The Supreme Court takes up this issue and, in several cases, strips away the power of both state governments and the federal government to regulate manufacturing, to regulate wages and hours, to institute a system of taxation. The Supreme Court becomes an obstacle to this major reform program that the progressives want to put in place. And one of the consequences of that is that presidents who want to implement this program become antagonists to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is frustrating a lot of the reform that the progressives wanted to implement at this time and makes the implementation of this new political economy much more difficult to achieve.
One of the ways this happened was the interpretation of the 14th Amendment, which had been put in place during Reconstruction after the Civil War to protect freed African Americans from the ability of states to control them, including to control how social and economic systems were structured. So it was a set of protections of individual freedoms, ostensibly originally for the protection of freedmen in the South. But it then becomes used in the early 20th century to protect what you might call economic freedoms, that is, the freedoms of individuals to decide their own conditions of labor and so on, which makes it therefore much harder to regulate industry.
The 14th Amendment does not speak specifically about the liberty of contract, but the Supreme Court of the 1880s interprets the 14th Amendment to imply liberty of contract. Liberty of contract meant that you, David, are hiring me as an employee. You have a lot of money. I don't have very much money, but I voluntarily enter an agreement with you. We sign an employment contract. I am doing this of my own free will. This freedom to arrange contracts between two ostensibly equal parties then gets constitutional protection. It's a fiction that me, a poor man, have as much negotiating power as you, a wealthy employer. But it's a fiction that gets embedded in law, and the sanctity of contract becomes such in Supreme Court interpretations that any effort to level the playing field between employers and workers in the early 20th century becomes an extremely difficult task for a government to accomplish. And this severely restricts the ability of the federal government to regulate manufacturing in the public interest.
Or of state governments, because originally it was to stymie state governments, the 14th Amendment.
And there was a famous case, the Lochner case in 1905, that was decided by the Supreme Court. And it referred to a state law that wanted to regulate the hours of bakeries, hours and wages of bakeries. And the Supreme Court intervenes and declares that state law unconstitutional from the reasoning that any employee in this bakery had voluntarily entered a contract with the bakery employers. And once that agreement was signed, there cannot be any regulation of it by the government, with a couple exceptions. If women or children are involved, interference can be made. But for male wage earners, there was no resort. So the Supreme Court is not simply declaring federal law that seeks to regulate manufacturing unconstitutional. It is also doing the same for state laws. And this makes the economy very difficult for governments to manage and inclines many, many politicians in the United States, including those holding highest offices like Theodore Roosevelt, to put themselves in opposition to the Supreme Court and to treat the Supreme Court as an unelected body, which is frustrating the will of the people, and that the people can't do what they want to do, that the elected officials can't do what they've been asked to do by the people. And so a profound critique of the court develops as an undemocratic element of government, which is frustrating and undermining the will of the people.
In his new nationalism speech, one really noticeable feature of it is that it has a strong strand of what he calls environmentalism, which is a relatively new feature, I think, of certainly national presidential politics. It is a part of his political persona. He's not a farmer. He's a Republican. This isn't agrarian America. But as you say, he's a hunter. He's a sportsman. He's an outdoors man. He's a soldier. He assembled his own unit to fight in the Spanish-American War. He's a man of extraordinary energy. I mean, he symbolizes not the countryside versus the city, but somehow the outdoors versus the indoors. He said various things that are still quoted today about the need for people to get out there and get their hands dirty. And this comes out in part in this speech as environmentalism. I'm just going to quote one line from the speech. Roosevelt said, "I recognize the right and duty of this generation to develop and use the natural resources of our land, but I do not recognize the right to waste them or to rob by wasteful use the generations that come after us." I take this to be a reaction against what big oil was doing, what the big railroads were doing, not in the name of the small farmers, but in the name of the land. Is this something new in American politics? This thinking about, it sounds quite 21st century, about the rights of future generations and our obligations to them. Clearly, all politics has some sense that we're doing this for our children and our grandchildren. But this is in relation to the use and the preservation of environmental resources.
Absolutely. He's the president who starts the National Park Service. A number of very famous national parks are established during his presidency. And he has two interests in protecting the land and protecting the environment. One is to preserve the sublime of America, the sense that America was born on the frontier. And it was born when Americans, frontiersmen, were struggling with and against the land. And there was something so profound and powerful about that struggle that Americans must find a way to preserve it for all time. They must have the opportunity to visit landscapes, extraordinary mountains and valleys and canyons, and have that experience of the sublime that their ancestors had experienced 50, 100, 150 years ago. And even if they're not ancestors, even if they're immigrants, they need to experience this element of the American experience. Now, he considered indigenous peoples to be part of this sublime, and he also believed in the virtue of being a warrior and engaging in battles on the frontier. And he wanted to be able to continue to imagine this history of conflict, often savage conflict on the frontier, that would remind Americans how the West was won, how the nation was won, and how the frontier continued to be a place of opportunity and fulfillment for individuals. So this is a very important part of his thinking. And he's also a conservationist. Conservation is not about the sublime. The conservation is about the best and efficient use of resources, so as to sustain the American economy, to sustain the American landscape, to sustain American resources for perpetuity. And he is reacting against what he considers to be the destruction of the land by petroleum, by coal mining, by all kinds of mining for other minerals in the West, corporations not taking care to make sure that the mines are producing efficiently, that the waste from those mines are not polluting and corrupting America's wilderness. So he's not opposed to economic development. He sees the conservation project as making economic development more efficient and at the same time making sure that America gets what it needs from its resources, but that there is a curatorship of those resources to take care not just of America's present, but its future. And this is part of his campaign to make the government the regulator, not just of industry, but the regulator of the environment. And so it is appropriate to see him as a pioneering environmentalist in that regard.
But he lost. And all of these things that he stood for, many of them filtered in. He's in some ways a classic third-party candidate. He lost the election, but his influence, as you say, on the administration that did win was profound. Wilson won this election. He didn't just win with less than a majority of the popular vote. He is another candidate who came into the convention in 1912 not as the favorite and left with the nomination in his pocket. And astonishingly, William Jennings Bryan was still a real power in the Democratic Party. And by this point, there were many who wanted him to run for a fourth time. There was a lot of pressure on Bryan to have another go. You'd think three defeats would be enough. The irony, of course, is that maybe this is the one election that he could have won because the Republicans were split. But Bryan threw his support behind Wilson at the convention against Wilson's rival, a man called Champ Clark. And partly it was because in a very closely fought, hotly contested convention, Tammany Hall came out behind Clark, and Bryan reacted against that. He did not want a Tammany Hall candidate. What had Tammany Hall come to mean in the politics of this period? I would say today, when I hear the phrase Tammany Hall, I think corruption, ballot stuffing, getting the vote out, but not maybe in the ways that would be thought to be fit for public consumption. Is that what Bryan is reacting against? Is it a reaction against the cities in New York? Is he trying to find a candidate, Wilson from the South, who can speak to those deeper traditions that he spoke for, those traditions of democratic politics that stretch back to Jefferson? Why was Tammany Hall the thing that switched Bryan to supporting Wilson?
Tammany Hall was known as the political machine that ran New York politics. Based in New York City, but also with a great voice in the capital of New York State, which was Albany. New York State was the most populous state in the nation at that time. And so what happened in New York carried enormous weight, not just within the state and regionally, but nationally as well. Tammany Hall was a sophisticated political operation that arose because of the hurly-burly character of the American electoral system and the need for party machines to orchestrate the vote, get it out on election day, and get people elected. They used all kinds of tactics, some legal, some illegal. They had an organization that reached down into the most local levels of New York politics. They were famous for having block captains throughout New York City, each responsible for a block of flats, going door to door, getting out the vote, tremendously successful, but also seen as unprincipled, not being progressive. Part of the progressive project was clean up politics, reform politics, the feeling that the big interests had so corrupted politics and machines had so corrupted politics that American politics had lost its virtue and had lost its character. And thus, part of the progressive movement was to eliminate machine politics altogether and to close off the widest avenues of corruption. One example of this is the direct election of senators by the people, because state legislatures were thought to be hopelessly corrupted by political machines. Other reforms put into place, the initiative in the referendum to sideline political parties. There was a major effort to clean up politics. This was a major goal of the progressive movement. And this is something that Bryan believes in deeply. And because the progressive movement had put such a premium on injecting more honesty and transparency into politics, Tammany was seen as a major enemy of reform and a force that had to be sidelined. And Bryan sees in Wilson an opportunity to deliver a defeat to a candidate that came to be seen as a figurehead for Tammany Hall. Ironically, the candidate, Champ Clark, had originally been designated as Bryan's successor because he was from Missouri. He carried an agrarian tradition, but he was seen as making his peace with the wrong elements of the Democratic Party. And Wilson was seen as being a cleaner candidate, somewhat ironically, because Wilson's ascension to the governorship of New Jersey in 1910, which had put him in place to get the nomination in 1912, had in part been orchestrated by a New Jersey political machine that saw him as a safe candidate without having strong reformist inclinations and someone who the machine could capably control.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wilson is one of the most extraordinary figures in American political history. The trajectory of his career is amazing. He's an unusual candidate for president and then president. He was a political scientist. There aren't many academic political scientists who wind up as president of the United States, though Obama wasn't exactly a political scientist, but he was an academic. He ran Princeton University before he ran New Jersey, before he ran the country. He was a man of the South. He was a racist. He had a clear sense of racial hierarchy. He was a defender of the racial order of the South. He faced the dilemma that progressive or reformist Democratic presidents in this period faced, and we will talk about Franklin Roosevelt next time. How do you use the power of the government to achieve the reforms that you want without frightening elected representatives of the South that that power will extend into dismantling Jim Crow politics? Wilson faced this dilemma too. I don't think it was a dilemma for him because he would do nothing to dismantle Jim Crow politics. The other extraordinary arc of his career is that he was a keep America out of European politics candidate. He was an anti-war candidate. Bryan, who'd become the great anti-war, anti-imperialist force in American politics, is bestowing his blessing ultimately on Wilson. Wilson's not a man to take America into new imperial adventures, or certainly not into European wars. A European war broke out in 1914. Wilson's reward to Bryan for having thrown his support behind him at the convention was to make him his Secretary of State. So in the first Wilson administration, they worked together and they were pretty much, I think, on the same page on many of the great foreign policy or international issues of the time, including when war breaks out in Europe in 1914. Neither man wanted to see America get involved in that war. And then steadily, bit by bit, the United States was drawn into that war, and Wilson himself, bit by bit, not in his first term, but in his second term, was eventually the man to lead America into that war. And America came out of that war the most powerful nation in the world, and Woodrow Wilson came out of that war in 1918 as one of the most powerful politicians in the history of the world. There was a brief period in 1918 when the American president, Woodrow Wilson, was the closest the world has ever had to a world king. It's astonishing. But it could have been Bryan. This, to me, is one of the counterfactuals. Bryan, the man who ran three times and lost, and then decided not to run in the one election that he maybe could have won. I don't know. Maybe he was damaged goods by that point. Wilson was a fresh face. And as you've said in a couple of these episodes, it's a real advantage in American presidential politics to come in as a relative unknown, which Woodrow Wilson was. But nonetheless, Taft and Roosevelt had split the Republican vote down the middle. 40%, 41%, 42% produced a thumping majority in the Electoral College. To me, it is not inconceivable that William Jennings Bryan could have come president of the United States in 1912 and maybe would have made Woodrow Wilson his Secretary of State. Again, counterfactuals are fun and they don't really mean anything, but they are fun. That's a different future, because William Jennings Bryan, I don't think, you never know, but I don't think William Jennings Bryan would have allowed the United States of America to join the First World War. And world history changes.
That's quite a counterfactual. You're right in characterizing both Wilson and Bryan as anti-war. They want nothing to do initially with this European conflict.
Imperial, monarchical, old world.
Yes, contaminating to the U.S. And America had a long interest of history of keeping its distance from these European politics, monarchs, aristocrats, intrigue.
Theocrats as well. The Russians were intimately involved. The Tsarist regime. Who's going to want to fight a war on the same side as the Tsar?
That's right. And so there was good reasons for America to keep its distance. And I think in the beginning of the war, they were equally committed to that proposition. But Wilson adhered to a policy of neutrality that is a particular legal doctrine of neutrality, which gave to non-belligerents, which the United States was, a right to trade fully with belligerents on both sides without restriction. It sounds innocent and direct, but it's complicated by the fact that U.S. trade was overwhelmingly with Britain, and U.S. foreign trade involved Germany a lot less. So to declare neutrality and to declare the right to have full relations with both belligerents meant, in effect, that the U.S. was claiming that it would continue a trade with Great Britain that was much greater and more fulsome and much more essential to the British war effort than to the German war effort. So neutrality, you can imagine a different definition of neutrality, which would have been to say, it's your conflict. This country is not trading with either of you. That's not how neutrality came to be defined in World War I. And so the insistence on this notion of neutrality meant that the U.S. had become much more implicated in supporting Britain than in trading with Germany.
One of Bryan's objections to this was Britain was also blockading Germany. So it was very hard for Germany to trade. And Bryan more or less said, if we were genuinely neutral in this conflict, we would be disapproving of this blockade, but we're not. He and Wilson started to part ways on that question.
Bryan wants genuine neutrality. And Bryan also understands that the blockade of Germany by Britain is going to compel Germany through other means to try and blockade Britain. It does not have the Navy to blockade Britain, but it has this extraordinary new machine called a submarine that it begins to use with devastating effectiveness. And one of the ships that it sinks is an American ship, the Lusitania, which was a passenger ship that the Germans accused of carrying munitions secretly in its hold, and the German claims were later shown to have been true. The Germans sink the ship, 1,200 Americans die, and this leads to cries for war in the United States. This is the crucial point of divergence between Bryan and Wilson, and Bryan, in a sense, admitting that Germany had cause, and that the only way for the United States to be neutral is to dissociate with both belligerents, which is something he was willing to do, or to impose sharp restrictions on U.S. trade with Britain for the sake of not antagonizing Germany. Wilson refuses to go along with that, and this becomes the reason for Bryan's resignation as Secretary of State. And the person who replaces Bryan is picked by Wilson so that Wilson's understanding of the neutrality laws can be enforced. And that has got to compel the United States step by step to think about entering the war on the side of Britain and France.
And eventually Russia, once Russia's got rid of the Tsar.
Yes, I think the Russian Revolution becomes crucial to legitimating Wilson's claim that he was not fighting as an ordinary belligerent. His justification for going to war was that this was going to be a war to end all wars, and this was going to be a war that would lead to the establishment of a League of Nations governed by an international constitution embodied in the 14 points. This was his justification, that out of this would come a different world. And Bryan says, I will have no part of this plan of yours because you're foolish to think that this can work. So Bryan's resignation is a resignation on the basis of principle, And his resignation is crucial to allowing Wilson to take the United States into war. If Bryan had been president, would he have been able to resist American intervention? It's a fascinating counterfactual. And here we have to consider not just Bryan's principles, but the pressure that would have been brought on him by industrial interests in the U.S. that were prospering by supplying munitions, supplies, and other things to Great Britain and France. And he would have faced tremendous opposition within the United States from these elite interests. It needs to be said that a critique develops of American involvement in World War I. It developed after World War I in the 1920s and 30s. The conviction that munitions makers and agricultural interests supplying the British and French armies and other industrial manufacturers supplying these armies with what they needed to go to war is what compelled American intervention. And the U.S. passes neutrality legislation in the 1930s to prevent the recurrence of a World War I intervention. The opposition to going to war within American society in 1914, 15, 16, and 17 was broad and deep. So it does suggest that there was a path forward for Bryan had he been president, that he might have been able to forestall American intervention. That probably would have led to a German victory in World War I, which gets us into yet another set of counterfactuals.
William Jennings Bryan is one of the most extraordinary Americans. His life was an astonishing life. Nearly president, the boy orator, still there, calling the shots in 1912. But he exits the scene of American public life at the Scopes trial, where he is the person charged with defending creationism against the teacher, John Scopes, who was trying to teach American school children about Darwin. And I don't know if he ended up as a figure of ridicule, not by all means to all Americans, but nonetheless, in some ways, for that career to end like that is its bathos.
Bryan did become a figure of ridicule in the 1920s by the Eastern establishment and by Eastern literati. Mencken, the dean of American letters, was withering in his criticism of Bryan for defending creationism, the notion that the world was created in 6 days, and the notion that the sun stood still at Jericho for 2 days. And I think he was no longer remembered as the great commoner.
Or the boy wonder. He was an old man as well by this point.
He died shortly thereafter. And Mencken and others portrayed him as having died of a broken heart because he was a broken man and made to look foolish by the attorney who was cross-examining him at the Scopes trial. He actually did not die of a broken heart. He had serious health issues and problems which would have killed him even if he had not testified in the Scopes trial. But it was an ignominious end for one of the great politicians of American history. And what was completely forgotten in that moment is that the agenda he put before America in the 1890s would be the agenda that over the next 3 to 4 decades, the Democratic Party would implement. And in the process, one might say, reshape America in the image of Bryan.
Bridge the divide that he couldn't bridge between rural and urban America.
And he got caught in the abyss in the 1920s between urban and rural America. So the Scopes trial was 1925. There was an election in 1924. And in the Democratic nominating convention of 1924, occurring in New York City, Madison Square Gardens, late June, early July, no air conditioning, beastly hot. It takes the Democratic Party 103 ballots to nominate a presidential candidate. On the one side was Al Smith, governor of New York, Irish Catholic, representing urban, non-Protestant, cosmopolitan America. On the other side was William McAdoo, Wilson's son-in-law, man of the South, man of North Carolina, representing Protestantism, Dixie, segregation, the Klan, anti-immigrant Führer. The gap between these two constituencies was so great that they seemed irreconcilable. 103 ballots, 10 days, after 103 ballots, both sides give up and nominate a nondescript corporation lawyer from West Virginia named John Davis, who gets crushed in the general election by Calvin Coolidge. It looks like the end of the Democratic Party. The person putting Al Smith's name in nomination is one Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whose appearance at the convention was his first appearance in public life since being stricken by polio 3 years before. He thought he had no more political future because the illness was so devastating and cost him forever the use of his legs. As he makes his triumphal return to the Democratic Party, he sees the Democratic Party destroying itself. It seems impossible, given that the depths of that division, that the Democratic Party could ever win again. And yet only 8 years later, this man becomes president of the United States. And he understands from the debacle of 1924 that the only way for the Democratic Party to flourish was to find a way to bridge the unbridgeable chasm between white Southern Protestants and urban Catholic and Jewish workers in the North. There would have been no New Deal but for his ability to effect a rapprochement that from the perspective of 1924 seemed impossible.
Today is the last day that you can get the first issue of our newsletter. You sign up by clicking on the link that you'll find in our show description. Coming tomorrow is issue 2, and that's the one that accompanies this series, with reading, ideas, facts and figures, all sorts of stuff about the elections that we've been talking about. Just click on the link in the show description and it will be in your inbox tomorrow. Coming up on this series, the next election is 1936. It wasn't the election that created the New Deal, but it was the one that sealed the deal. That will be available on Sunday. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.